Saxon threaded his way through the bustling crowd, nodding briskly to the few guards he passed. He'd almost reached the stairs when a guard officer appeared out of nowhere right in front of him, and he had to stop or run the man down. The officer glared at him, and Saxon remembered just in time to salute him. The officer grunted and returned the salute.
What the hell do you think you're doing? Appearing on duty looking like that? Your uniform's a disgrace. Your chainmail looks like it was made for a deformed dwarf, and that was the sloppiest damn salute I've ever seen. What's your name and your unit?
Oh, hell, I don't need this. I really don't.
He glanced quickly around to make sure no one was looking, and then gave the officer a vicious punch well below the belt. All the color drained out of the officer's face, and his legs buckled. Saxon grabbed him before he fell, and quickly walked him across the hall and back into the side corridor. He shook his head woefully at a passing guest.
Don't touch the shellfish.
The guest blinked and hurried on his way. Saxon waited a moment till the corridor was deserted, and then knocked the officer out with a crisp blow to the jaw. It was only a matter of a few seconds to stuff the guard officer into the closet along with the first guard. Saxon hurried back into the hall and ran straight into another officer. This time he remembered to salute. The new officer returned it absent-mindedly.
I'm looking for Major Tierman. Have you seen him?
No, sir. Haven't seen him all day.
What do you mean you haven't seen him all day? This is your commanding officer we're talking about. What's your name and unit?
Oh, well.
If you'll follow me, sir, I think I can take you right to the Major.
Back in the side corridor, Saxon finished stuffing the unconscious officer into the closet and forced the door shut. He'd better not run into any more officers or he'd have to find another closet. He set off again at a brisk walk with a very determined expression that he hoped suggested he was going somewhere very important and shouldn't be detained. He flexed the fingers of his right hand thoughtfully. There was one thing to be said about his new strength. When he hit someone, they stayed hit. He doubted the two officers and the guard would be waking up for a good few hours yet. More than enough time for him to take his vengeance on the two kings and depart. The main parlor turned out to be full of people trying to look important. The two kings sat in state at the back of the room, surrounded by an ever-shifting mob of courtiers, local quality, and guards. Any assassin trying to get close to the monarchs would probably have been trampled underfoot in the crush long before he got anywhere near his targets. No one even noticed Saxon's entrance. He took up a position by the door, not too far from the buffet table, and studied the layout of the room. No one paid him any attention. He was just another guard. He watched the two kings for a time. They didn't look like much. Take away their crowns and their gorgeous robes of state, and you wouldn't look at them twice in a crowd. But those two men, both in their late 40s, were symbols of their countries and the parliaments that governed them. A blow struck against them would be heard across the world. But of even more importance was the peace treaty, standing on display in a simple glass case between the two kings. Two copies of the treaty stood side by side under the glass, one for each parliament. Two sheets of pale cream parchment covered with the very best copperplate calligraphy, awaiting only the king's signatures to make them law. Saxon smiled slowly. He flexed his leg and felt the leather canister press against his bare skin. Inside the canister were two sheets of pale cream parchment, carefully rolled and protected by padding. From a distance, they looked exactly like the treaty. And once Saxon swapped them for the real treaty, no one would be able to tell the difference. Not until it was far too late. Saxon put a great deal of thought into his first act of vengeance. It wasn't enough just to hurt those in authority. They had to be publicly humiliated. His two sheets of parchment were covered with copperplate calligraphy, but a minor avoidance spell Saxon purchased from the son of one of his old contacts would ensure no one studied the text too closely. The spell was too subtle and too minor to set off any security alarms, and would fade away completely in a matter of hours anyway. By then, the damage would have been done. Both the kings would have put their signatures, and thereby their parliament's approval, to a treaty that declared the authorities of both countries to be corrupt and incompetent, complete and utter bastards without a single trace of human feeling. The text went on like that for some time, in increasingly lengthy and insulting detail. Saxon wrote it himself in a fury of white-hot inspiration and was rather proud of it. And the kings were going to sign it, right there in public with everyone watching. They'd never live it down. When word got out, as it inevitably would, as to exactly what they'd put their names to, a shockwave of incredulous laughter would wash across Outremer and the Low Kingdoms. The more the authorities tried to suppress and deny the story, the more people would flock to read or listen to pirated copies of the false treaty, and the wider the story would spread. The first part of Saxon's vengeance would have begun. More practical jokes and humiliations would follow, and no one would be safe from ridicule. Powers that would stand firm against intrigue and violence were helpless when it came to defending themselves against derisive laughter. It's hard to be scared of someone when their very appearance is enough to start you giggling. Saxon's grin broadened. After today, both the kings and their parliaments were going to be laughingstocks. Saxon looked around one last time and let his hands drift casually to his trouser pockets, reaching for the smoke bombs he put there. One to go into the open fire, and the second for an emergency exit if necessary. Under cover of the smoke and chaos, and while the security people protected the kings from any attack, it would be child's play for him to open the glass case and make the substitution. The real parchments would disappear into his leather canister. It would be all over before the smoke cleared, and afterwards it should be easy enough for a single guard to disappear in all the confusion. It was a superb plan, simple but elegant. Nothing could go wrong. Daniel Madigan stood openly in the street under a rain avoidance spell, watching Champion House from the middle of a crowd of onlookers waiting patiently for a glimpse of the two kings. Horn and Eleanor Todd stood on either side of him, watching the crowd, just in case. The young killer Ellis Glenn stood beside Todd, shifting impatiently from foot to foot. They'd been watching the house for the best part of an hour, waiting for a signal from the traitors inside the house. The signal would tell them that the protective wards had been temporarily lowered, and then the fun could begin. But until then, they could only wait and watch. Even with the sorcerer shaman Rittenhour working for him, Madigan wasn't prepared to take on the kind of magical defenses the king's sorcerers would have set up. He hadn't made his reputation by being stupid or impatient. Rittenhour himself stood a little way from his new associates. Their constant aura of suppressed violence disturbed him. To his eyes, the house was surrounded by an ever-shifting aurora of lights and vibrations, flaring here and there with deadly intent. The magic within him stirred at the sight of it. He looked thoughtfully at the terrorists. He still wasn't sure why he stayed here. The more he thought about what Madigan planned, the less tempting the money seemed. He could still leave. Rittenhour had no loyalty to anyone save himself, let alone anything as nebulous as a cause. And he didn't trust fanatics, particularly when it came to their paying their bills. But when all was said and done, he was intrigued, curious to see if Madigan could bring off his plan. And perhaps, just perhaps, he stayed with Madigan because he knew the terrorist would kill him if he tried to back out now. Horn looked at Glenn.
Can't keep still for a moment, can you? Like a big kid, aren't you, Alice?
Don't call me that.
Glenn blushed despite himself, but his eyes were cold.
I've told you, my name is Ellis.
Well, that's what I said. Alice. It's a nice name. Suits a good looker like you. Tell you what, you do good in there today, and I'll get you a nice big bunch of flowers and a ribbon for your hair. How about that?
If you don't shut up, I'm gonna kill you, Horn. Right here and now.
Now, Alice, behave yourself, or I'll have to spank you.
Glenn's hand dropped to the sword at his side, and Todd glanced at Horn.
That's enough. Leave the boy alone.
Glenn shot her a look of almost puppyish adoration and gratitude, and looked away. Horn chuckled.
Oh, I think he fancies you, Eleanor. Isn't that nice? All girls together.
Todd glared at him, and Horn looked away, still chuckling. He didn't say anything more. Much as he enjoyed teasing Glenn and challenging Todd's authority, he knew he could only push it so far before Madigan stepped in. Horn wasn't stupid enough to upset Madigan. Over anything. He glanced surreptitiously at Eleanor Todd. Before Madigan had brought her into the group, he'd been second in command, Madigan's voice. And if something were to happen to her, he might be again. Of course, he'd have to be very careful. If Madigan even suspected he was plotting something against another member of the group, the thought alone was enough to stop him from chuckling, and he went back to studying the house. Glenn stared straight ahead of him, not really seeing the crowd or the house. He could feel the warmth of the betraying blush still beating in his face, and his hands had clenched into fists at his sides. The need to cut and thrust and kill was almost overpowering, but he held it back. If he let it loose too soon, Madigan would be disappointed in him, and Glenn would have cut off his own hand rather than disappoint Madigan. He had turned Glenn's life around, given him a cause and a purpose, told him that his talent for death was a skill and an asset, not something to hide or be ashamed of. Madigan understood his dark needs and bloody dreams, and taught him to control and channel them. Now he killed only at Madigan's order, and the joy was that much sweeter. Glenn wondered if Eleanor saw him blushing. He worshipped her almost as much as he did Madigan, though for different reasons. He'd kill for Madigan, but he'd die for Eleanor. She was everything he dreamed of being, a cool professional killer who stood at Madigan's right hand, his trusted support and confidant. She was also heart-stoppingly beautiful, and on the few occasions when she actually smiled at him, he walked around in a daze for minutes. He never told her how he felt, of course. He saw the way she looked at Madigan. But still he dreamed, and it was only in his dreams that it occurred to him that Eleanor might look more kindly on him if Madigan wasn't around any longer. Bailey strode through the crowd to rejoin his associates, and people hurried to get out of his way. His huge frame was intimidating, even when he was trying his best to be inconspicuous. Rittenhour was glad to see the big man back again, even though he couldn't stand the fellow. Madigan had sent the warrior out on reconnaissance almost an hour ago, and the long wait wore at everyone's nerves. Everyone except Madigan, of course. Bailey ground to a halt before Madigan and nodded briefly.
Everything's set. The men are all in position, awaiting your signal to begin.
Are you sure we can trust these men? If they let us down or turn against us, we're dead.
Relax, Shaman. These are professional fighting men, every one. 100 of the very best, gathered and placed under contract outside Haven so as not to draw unwelcome attention. We can trust them to fight and die like any other mercenary, particularly on the wages they've been promised.
I'd have thought you'd be happier with fanatics, ready to die for their cause.
I don't want men who can die, I want men who can win. That's enough questions for now, Shaman, we have work to do.
If you'd take the time to fill me in on what's happening, I wouldn't have to keep asking questions.
You know all you have to. Now be quiet, or I'll have Bailey remonstrate with you.
Rittenhour looked at the huge warrior looming over him and decided there was nothing to be gained by pushing Madigan any further. He had to know more about the terrorists' plans if he was to know the best time to cut and run, but that could wait. He had no intention of leaving without his money anyway, and he also had to be sure Madigan was in no position to come after him. Rittenhour gazed haughtily up at Bailey, turned his back on him, and fixed his attention on Champion House. A light flared briefly in an upper window. There was a slight pause, and then it flashed again. Madigan nodded calmly.
About time, Sir Roland. Bailey, give the signal. The wards are finally down, and we can proceed.
Bailey waved his hand over his head. The mercenaries appeared from everywhere, with swords and axes in their hands. They came from among the gawking crowd, from the beggars at the main gate, and from every side street and alleyway. They were in a multitude of disguises, but all of them wore the identifying black iron toque of the mercenary on their wrists. They threw themselves at the various gates in the house's outer walls. The honor guards fought well and valiantly, but were quickly overwhelmed by the sheer number of their attackers. The mercenaries hurtled their twitching bodies and raced on into the grounds. Madigan led his people through the panicking crowd and approached the main gate. A small band of guards had slammed the gate in the mercenaries' faces and were somehow still holding their ground behind the gate's heavy steel framework. Madigan looked at Rittenhour, who nodded quickly. He gestured at the guards.
Rittenhour!
The guards fell screaming to the ground as the blood boiled like acid in their veins. Steam rose from their twisting bodies as the acid ate holes in their flesh. Rittenhour gestured again, and the gate swung open, pushing the guards' bodies out of the way. Madigan led his people through the open gate and into the grounds, smiling quietly at the chaos his mercenaries had caused. A small army of guards and men-at-arms spilled out of the house and stared wildly about them, confused and disoriented because the security wards had failed them. The mercenaries fell upon them like starving wolves, and blades flashed dully in the rain. Madigan cut down the first defender to get in his way with a single stroke of his sword, and passed on without slowing. Bailey strode at his side, wielding his great sword with casual professional skill. No one could stand against his strength and skill, and only the desperate or the foolish even tried. Horn and Eleanor Todd busied themselves opening up a bloody path for Madigan to walk through. Glenn fought where he would, cutting down opponents as fast as he could reach them. His face was wild and horribly happy, and his chainmail was thickly spattered with other men's blood. He was always in the thick of the fighting, but no one could touch him. He killed wherever his eyes fell, and it was never enough. Rittenhour hurried to keep up with the others, saving his magic as much as he could. He was going to need all his power for the horrible thing Madigan wanted him to do later. Finally, they came to the main parlor on the fourth floor, and Madigan stood for a moment in the doorway, smiling around at the terrified guests. The guards and men-at-arms in the room were all dead, the bodies left to lie where they had fallen. 20 mercenaries surrounded the guests with drawn swords, and a small pile of mostly ceremonial swords and daggers at one side showed that the prisoners had already been disarmed. Madigan nodded approvingly and walked unhurriedly into the room, flanked by Horn and Eleanor Todd. He stopped before the two kings, sitting stiffly in their chairs with knives at their throats, and bowed politely.
Your Majesties, I do beg your pardon for this intrusion. Allow me to assure you that as long as you and your guests behave yourselves, there is no reason why most of you shouldn't leave this room alive. And please don't delude yourselves with any thought of rescue. My men now control this house and its surrounding grounds. Your men are dead.
A gray-haired general from the Outremer delegation stepped forward, ignoring the swords that moved to follow him. His uniform had been pressed within an inch of its life, and his right breast bore ribbons from a dozen major campaigns. His face was flushed with anger, and his eyes met Madigan's unflinchingly.
You won't get away with this. By now, this whole area is surrounded by enough armed men to outnumber your little army 100 times over. You don't have a hope in hell of getting out of here alive. Surrender now, and I'll see you get a fair trial.
Madigan nodded to Horn, who stepped forward and plunged his sword into the general's belly. The general looked down at the sword unbelievingly. Horn twisted the blade, and blood poured down between the general's legs. He sank to his knees. Horn withdrew the blade, and the general fell forward onto the bloody carpet. Madigan looked calmly about him.
I trust there'll be no more outbursts. Any further unpleasantness will be dealt with most firmly.
Rittenhour took advantage of the pause to surreptitiously study 4 bodies in sorcerer's black that had been dumped unceremoniously in a pile by the door. Their faces were pale, their eyes bulged unseeing from their sockets, and their lips were tinged with blue.
Poison. No wonder the king's sorcerers were unable to maintain the house's wards or defend against the mercenaries' attack. Madigan's pet traitors must have doctored their wine.
Rittenhour looked up quickly as a mercenary came running into the room and whispered at length to Bailey. The big man nodded and moved forward to murmur in Madigan's ear. The terrorist smiled and turned back to face his reluctant audience.
You'll no doubt be relieved to hear that the authorities have been informed of your plight, and negotiations for your release will soon begin. Now, I suppose you're wondering what this is all about. It's really very simple. Everyone here will be released unharmed when the authorities agree to meet my demands, which are very reasonable under the circumstances. I want 1 million ducats in gold and silver, carts to transport it, and a ship waiting at the docks to carry us away from Haven. I also want a number of political prisoners freed from jails in the Low Kingdoms and Outremer. A list of names and locations will be provided.
King Gregor of the Low Kingdoms leaned forward slightly, careful of the knife at his throat. His narrow, waspish features did little to hide the anger boiling within him, but when he spoke, his voice was calm and even.
And if our respective parliament should refuse to go along with your demands, what then?
King Louis of Outremer nodded firmly, imperiously ignoring the knife at his throat. His unremarkable face had the constant redness that comes from too much good food and drink, but his smile was unflinchingly arrogant, and his eyes were full of a cold, contemptuous fury.
They won't pay. They can't afford to give in to terrorist scum, not even for us.
The monarch's smile widened slightly.
If we'd been the prime ministers, you might have gotten away with it. But our parliaments won't pay a single penny for us, or release a single prisoner. They can't afford to look weak, or they'd end up the target of every terrorist group with a grudge or a cause.
I hope for your sake that you're wrong. If my demands are not met before the deadline I've set, I'll have no choice but to begin killing your guests, one at a time. and sending out the bodies to convince the authorities I mean business. If that doesn't impress them, I'll start sending out pieces of your royal anatomy. I think I'll begin with the teeth. They should last a while.
Madigan looked away from the silent kings and smiled at the assembled guests who shrank before his cold gaze.
Do make yourselves comfortable, my friends. We're in for something of a wait, I fear, before Haven's authorities can get their scattered wits together enough to begin negotiations. And remember, as long as you behave yourselves, you'll be well treated. Annoy me, and I'll have my men hurt some of you severely, as an example to the others. And please, put all thoughts of rescue out of your minds. You're mine now.
He looked at Horn and Todd.
Take them into the adjoining rooms in small groups, and have the mercenaries search them thoroughly. I don't want anyone harboring any nasty surprises. Strip them if necessary, and confiscate anything that even looks dangerous.
He looked back at the white-faced guests.
Anyone who wishes to give up their little secrets now to avoid any unpleasantness is, of course, welcome to do so.
There was a pause, and then several men and a few of the ladies produced hidden knives and dropped them on the floor. Two mercenaries quickly gathered up the weapons and put them with the other confiscated blades. Madigan waited patiently, and one lady pulled a long hatpin from her hair and offered it to the nearest mercenary, who took it with a grin and a knowing wink. The lady ignored him. Wolf Saxon raised his hand politely. Madigan looked at him.
If you want to visit the Jakes, you'll have to wait.
I have a document container strapped to my leg. I don't want it confused for a weapon.
Then I think we'd better have a look at it, just to be sure. Drop your trousers.
Saxon looked around him, and Madigan smiled.
We're all friends together here. Now take them off, or I'll have someone take them off for you.
Saxon undid his belt and lowered his trousers with immense dignity. Madigan approached him and prodded the leather canister with the tip of his sword. Saxon didn't flinch.
What's in the container?
Documents. I'm a courier.
Take it off and give it to me.
Saxon did so, as slowly as he dared. He hoped that by revealing the canister openly, he could bluff them into thinking it was unimportant and therefore not worth opening. But he couldn't refuse a direct order from Madigan. Not if he wanted to keep his teeth where they were. On the other hand, he couldn't afford to hand over the fake treaties. They'd break the avoidance spell easily once they realized what it was, and once they read the parchments, they'd be bound to ask all sorts of awkward questions. Whatever happened then, his chance of vengeance would be gone.
Terrorists?
He'd planned for anything but that. He still had his smoke bombs, but it was a long way to the door, and the solitary double windows overlooked a hell of a long drop to the unforgiving flagstones below. Even he might not survive a fall of four stories. Besides, both the house and the grounds were apparently occupied by mercenaries. There could be a whole army out there for all he knew, and there were definite limits to his strength and speed, especially with his trousers around his ankles. He handed the leather canister over to Madigan as casually as he could. There was a way out of this. There had to be. A dozen possible stratagems ran through his mind as Madigan opened the canister, looked briefly at the parchments, and then turned the receptacle upside down and shook it to check there was nothing else inside but the padding. He sniffed, unimpressed, and dropped the canister and the parchments onto the buffet table. Saxon almost gaped at him. The terrorist obviously considered him completely harmless and unimportant. The nerve of the man! Saxon was so outraged he almost forgot to be relieved about the parchments. He'd make the terrorist pay for this insult. He didn't know how yet, but he'd think of something. In the meantime...
Excuse me, but can I pull my trousers back up?
Of course. We're not barbarians.
Saxon pulled his pants back up and forced the belt shut, regretting once again that he couldn't have found a larger guard to steal a uniform from. It suddenly struck him that it was only a matter of time before Madigan's people discovered the guard and the two officers he'd stuffed into the closet. Madigan didn't look the type to suffer mysteries long. Saxon scowled mentally. The sooner he figured out a way to shake off the terrorists and disappear, the better. Not that he had any intention of leaving Champion House just yet. No one insulted him, ruined one of his scams, and got away with it. He had his reputation to think of. The kings could wait. Madigan and his terrorists were going to rue the day they ever crossed Wolf Saxon. Rittenhour found himself a comfortable chair and gave some serious attention to the plateful of food he'd gathered from the buffet. Nothing like hard work to give you a good appetite. He offered a chicken leg to Bailey, but the big man ignored him, presumably too professional to allow himself to be distracted while on duty. Rittenhour took a healthy bite from the chicken leg and chewed thoughtfully as he studied his fellow conspirators. Glenn was almost falling over himself trying to impress Bailey with accounts of his part in the storming of Champion House. Bailey listened indulgently, though his gaze never left the captives. Madigan and Todd talked quietly together. Rittenhour still wasn't sure about them. Sometimes they seemed like partners or even lovers, but at other times Madigan treated her as just another follower. Horn watched the two of them covertly, clearly jealous of the attention Todd got from Madigan. Rittenhour filed the thought away for future reference. It might come in handy to have something divisive to use against his new associates. They were all too eager to give everything for their precious cause, for his liking. Rittenhour had no intention of giving anything that mattered for anybody's cause. He thought again of what Madigan wanted him to do down in the cellar, and the parlor seemed suddenly colder. Hawk waded through dark, knee-high water in the sewers under the west side and tried hard not to recognize some of the things floating on the surface. Fisher moved scowling at his side, holding her lantern high to spread the light as far as possible. She kept a careful eye on the flame. If it flickered and changed color, it meant the gases in the air were growing dangerously poisonous. There were supposed to be old spells built into the sewers to prevent the buildup of such gases, but judging by the smell, they weren't working too well. Hawk wrinkled his nose and tried to breathe only through his mouth. If the air had been any thicker, he could have cut it with his axe. Jessica Winter plodded along just behind the two guards, looking around her with interest. If the smell bothered her, it didn't show in her face. Hawk smiled slightly. Winter wasn't the sort to admit to any weakness, no matter how trivial. Barber and MacReady brought up the rear, plugging steadily along in Winter's wake. Hawk scowled and turned his thoughts toward Storm. While they were all up to their knees in it, the sorcerer was probably sitting in some nice dry office with his feet up, following it all with his sight and grinning a lot. He couldn't go with them, he'd explained, in a voice positively dripping with mock disappointment, because the terrorists raised the house's defensive wards again, and no sorcerer could even approach Champion House without setting off all kinds of alarms. The house's wards were apparently so powerful it would have taken every sorcerer in the city working together to breach them, and the terrorists threatened to kill both kings if the wards even looked like they were going down. Champion House was an old house with a great deal of magic built into its walls. It had been built to withstand a siege, and that was exactly what it was doing. That was why Hawk was up to his knees in stinking water and wishing he was somewhere else. Anywhere else. A study of the house's architectural plans revealed that it had been built directly over the ruins of an old slaughterhouse. The west side hadn't always been fashionable. And supposedly, there were still tunnels leading from the cellar straight into the sewers. So, theoretically, it should be possible for the SWAT team to break into the cellar from the sewers without being noticed. The wards were worn thin down there. For some reason, Storm didn't understand, and could be breached by a small force that had been suitably prepared. Hawk pressed Storm on this point, but the sorcerer grew unusually evasive. He just insisted that he could keep any alarms from going off, and that was all that mattered. Then he looked away and said quietly that the cellar had originally belonged to another, even older building, and the slaughterhouse had been built on its ruins. He didn't know what the original building had been, but just making mental contact with the cellar made his skin crawl. Storm didn't tell Hawk to be careful. He didn't have to. All of which hadn't filled Hawk with confidence, but as Winter kept pointing out, she was the team leader, and she was determined to go in. So they went in. Hawk smiled sourly. There were lots of things about the sewers that weren't on any map. Half the sorcerers and alchemists in Haven flushed their failed experiments down into the sewers, producing an unholy mixture of chemicals and forces that gave nightmares to anyone who thought about it too much. Oversized rats were the least of the unpleasant things to prowl the sewer darkness. Cobwebs hung everywhere, strung across the walls and beaded here and there with moisture. Hanging strands of slimy gossamer twitched occasionally as wafts of warm air moved through the tunnels. In places, the webs became so thick they half blocked the tunnels, and Hawk had to cut his way through with his axe. Sometimes he found the remains of dead rats and tiny homunculi cocooned in the webbing, along with other things he couldn't identify and wasn't sure he wanted to. He tried hard not to think about crawling Jenny or how big a spider would have to be to produce such webs. He'd never liked spiders. Fisher moved in close beside him so that they could talk quietly without being overheard.
I once talked with one of the maintenance men whose job it is to clean out these tunnels twice a year. He said there wasn't enough money in the world to get him to come down here more often than that. He'd seen things. Heard things.
What sort of things?
Fisher moved in even closer.
Once, they found a blind angel with tattered wings from the Street of Gods. They offered to guide it out, but it wouldn't go. It said it was guilty, but wouldn't say what it was guilty of. Another time, the slime on top of the water came alive and attacked them. Someone smashed a lantern against it, and it burst into flames. It rolled away into the darkness, screaming in a dozen voices. And once, they saw a spider as big as a dog, spinning a cocoon around something even larger.
Anything else?
There are always stories. Some say this is where all the aborted babies end up, neither living nor dead. They crawl around in the tunnels in the dark, looking for a way out, and never finding it.
If you've got any more cheerful stories, do me a favor and keep them to yourself. They're just stories. Look, we've been down here almost an hour now, and we haven't seen a damn thing so far, not even a rat.
Yeah, that is suspicious.
Whose stupid idea was this, anyway?
Yours, originally.
Why do you listen to me?
Aren't any rats, it can only be because something else has been preying on them.
She stopped suddenly, and Hawk stopped to look at her. She cocked her head slightly to one side, listening.
Hawk, can you hear something?
Hawk strained his ears against the quiet. The rest of the team had stopped, too, and the last echoes from their progress through the water died away into whispers. The silence gathered around them like a watchful predator, waiting for them to make a mistake. Fisher held her lantern higher, her hand brushing against the tunnel roof, but the light still couldn't penetrate far into the darkness. Winter moved forward through the water to join them.
Why have we stopped?
Isabel thought she heard something ahead.
I did hear something.
I've been aware of something, too, just at the edge of my hearing. Sometimes I think it's behind us, sometimes out in front.
There's something out there. I can feel its presence.
They all looked at him.
Any idea what it is?
No, but it's close now. Very close.
Great. Thanks a lot, MacReady.
Hawk reached out with his mind to Storm, using the mental link the sorcerer established with the team before they left.
Hey, Storm. You there?
For the moment, Captain Hawk. The closer you get to the house's walls, the harder it is for me to make contact.
Can you tell what's ahead of us in the dark?
I'm sorry, Captain. My sight is useless under these conditions, but you should all be wary. There's a lot of magic in Champion House. Old magic. Bad magic. And its proximity to the sewers is bound to have had unfortunate effects on whatever lives there.
A lot of help you are, Sorcerer.
Hawk broke the contact and hefted his axe.
Well, we can't go back, and according to the plans, there's no other way that'll get us where we're going. So, we go on. And if there is anything up ahead, we'd better hope it's got enough sense to stay out of our way.
Everyone, draw their weapons. And Hawk, since you're so keen to make all the decisions, you can lead the way.
You're so good to me. Let's go, people.
He led the way forward into the dark, feeling Winter's angry look burning into his back. He didn't mean to keep undermining her position as leader, but he wasn't used to taking orders, and he couldn't wait around and keep quiet while she made up her mind. It wasn't in his nature. As they moved on, the sounds grew suddenly louder and more distinct, and Hawk stopped, glaring ahead into the gloom. The others stopped with him, and Fisher moved in close beside him, her sword at the ready. Something was coming toward them out of the darkness, not even bothering to hide its presence anymore. Something so large and heavy, its progress pushed the air before it like a breeze. Hawk could feel the air pressing against his face. A dozen red gleams appeared high up in the gloom before him, shining like fire in the night. Hawk lifted his axe as a horrid suspicion stirred within him. The glaring eyes, the soft sounds, and everywhere he looked, the endless webbing.
Oh, hell. Not spiders. Anything but that.
The atmosphere in the parlor was getting dangerously tense, and Saxon was getting worried. There'd been no word on how negotiations were going, but whatever the terrorists' deadline was, it had to be getting closer. Madigan had disappeared with his people some time back, leaving 20 mercenaries to watch the hostages. Talking wasn't allowed, and the mercenaries had taken an almost sadistic pleasure in denying the hostages food or drink while taking turns at stuffing their own faces. Time dragged on, and the mercenaries grew bored while the hostages grew restless. Sooner or later, someone on one side or the other was going to do something stupid just to break the monotony, which would be all the excuse the mercenaries needed to indulge in a little fun and games. Saxon smiled coldly. Whatever happened, he wasn't going to make any trouble. The terrorists could kill every man and woman in the room, and he wouldn't care. These people represented all the vile and corrupt authority that made Haven what it was. He was in no real danger himself. He had a way out, just in case things started getting really out of hand. Saxon knew Champion House well from his earlier days, when he'd been a rising politician and much courted by those seeking patronage or influence with the Council. What Saxon knew, and presumably the terrorists didn't, was that the house was riddled with secret doors and hidden passageways, a holdover from the house's original owners, who raised the fortune needed to build Champion House by being Haven's most successful smugglers. Apparently, the passages with their magically warded walls came in handy more than once for concealing goods and people from investigating customs officers outraged at being denied their rightful cut. As far as Saxon knew, the passages were still there, unless they'd been discovered and blocked off during the years while he was away. Either way, if he remembered correctly, there was a concealed door right there in the parlor, not too far away. All he had to do was press a section of the paneling in just the right place, and the wall would open, and he'd be gone before the mercenaries knew what was happening. That was the theory, anyway. But he didn't think he'd try it until he had no other choice. The way his luck had been going, the secret door would probably turn out to be nailed shut and booby-trapped. The tension was so thick on the air now he could practically taste it. The two kings sat stiffly but not without dignity, trying to set a good example. No one paid them much attention. The military types watched the mercenaries like hawks, waiting for someone to make a slip. The quality pointedly ignored the mercenaries, as though hoping they might go away once they realized how unwelcome they were. The merchants stood close together and kept a hopeful watch on the closed door. They'd given up on trying to bribe the mercenaries, but they obviously still thought they could make some kind of deal with Madigan or one of his people. Saxon knew better. He knew fanatics when he saw them, and this bunch worried the hell out of him. It was clear they had their own agenda. If they were as committed to their cause as they seemed, once they started, they wouldn't turn aside for hell or high water. You'd have to kill them all to stop them. Saxon glanced again at the hidden door, and his hand tightened around the smoke bomb he'd palmed while he was being searched. If trouble broke out, he was off, and to hell with all of them. Whatever the terrorists were up to, it was none of his business. The door slammed, and even the mercenaries jumped. Eleanor Todd stood in the doorway with the young killer Glenn at her side. Saxon's heart sank. He could tell from their faces that the deadline came and went without being met. Todd looked calm, almost bored, but there was an air of unfocused menace about her, as though she was readying herself for some gory but necessary task. Glenn grinned broadly. Todd looked unhurriedly about her, and the hostages stared back like so many rabbits, mesmerized by a snake.
It seems your city council has chosen not to take us seriously. They have refused to meet our legitimate demands. It's time we showed them we are not to be trifled with. It's time for one of you to die.
She let her gaze drift casually over the hostages, and faces paled when her gaze lingered for a moment before passing on. People began to edge away from each other, as though afraid proximity to the one chosen might prove dangerous. No one raised a voice in protest. A few of the braver souls looked as though they might, but one look from Glenn was all it took to silence them. Saxon held the smoke bomb loosely in his hand and cast about for a good spot to lob it. He'd wait until Todd had chosen her victim and all eyes were on them, and then he'd make his move. Eleanor Todd finally stepped forward and smiled at a young girl in the front row, not far from where Saxon was standing. The girl couldn't have been more than 14 or 15, some merchant's daughter wearing her first formal gown to an important function. She'd been vaguely pretty before, but now sheer terror made her face ugly as she tried to back away from Todd's smile. Her father stepped forward to stand before her, opening his mouth to protest. Todd hit him with a vicious low blow. He fell to the floor. Glenn strolled forward and kicked him casually in the face a few times. The girl stared desperately around her for help, but no one would meet her eyes. She turned back to Todd and held herself erect with a pathetic attempt at dignity. Her face was so pale, her few amateurish attempts at makeup stood out against her pallor like a child's daubings.
It's nothing personal. We always choose a young girl for our first execution. Makes more of an impact. Don't worry. It'll all be over before you know it.
My name is Christina Rutherford. My family will avenge my death.
Your name doesn't matter, girl. Only the cause matters. Now, will you walk, or would you rather be dragged?
I'll walk. I just want to say goodbye to my family and friends.
How touching. But we don't have time. Glenn, drag her.
His grin broadened. Christina shrank away from him. Tears ran down her face as Glenn grabbed her by the arm and pulled her toward the door.
Damn.
Saxon stepped forward to block their way.
That's enough, Glenn. Let her go.
Get out of the way, guard, or we'll take you too.
Try it.
Glenn thrust Christina behind him. Todd took her firmly by the arms. Glenn studied Saxon thoughtfully.
So, someone here's got some guts after all. I was hoping someone had. Now I get to have some fun. How far do you think you can run, hero, with your intestines dragging around your ankles?
His sword was suddenly in his hand, and he lunged forward incredibly quickly. Saxon sidestepped at the last moment, and the blade's edge just caressed the chainmail over his ribs as it hissed past. Glenn stumbled forward, caught off balance, and Saxon brought his knee up savagely. Glenn fell to his knees. Saxon kicked him in the ribs, slamming him back against the wall. Saxon leaned forward and picked up Glenn's sword, ignoring the unpleasant sounds behind him as the young killer vomited painfully. He turned to face Eleanor Todd, who had a knife at Christina's throat. The young girl looked at him with the beginnings of hope. The mercenaries standing around the room were staring at him open-mouthed. Saxon flashed them his most confident politician's smile and then looked back at Todd.
Let the girl go. We can talk about this.
No, I don't think so.
Todd drew the knife quickly across Christina's throat and then pushed the girl away from her. She fell to her knees, her eyes wide in horror. She tried to scream. Blood ran thickly down her neck and chest, and she put her hands to her throat as though she could hold the wound together. But the blood gushed through her fingers. She held out a bloody hand to Saxon, but she was already dead by the time he took it. He lowered her body to the floor, then looked up at Todd. There was death in his eyes, but she didn't flinch.
You bitch. You didn't have to do that.
She wasn't important. At least she died in a good cause. Now it's your time to die, hero. Can't have the sheep getting ideas, can we?
She gestured impatiently to the watching mercenaries, and they began to close in.
I'll kill you for this. I'll kill you all.
He threw the smoke bomb onto the floor before him, and it cracked open, spilling out thick clouds of choking black smoke that billowed quickly through the parlor. Todd lashed out with her sword, but Saxon was already gone, sprinting for the hidden door. He found the right stretch of paneling, hit it smartly in just the right place, and a section of the wall swung open on silent counterweights. Saxon darted forward into the gloomy passageway as a knife came flying out of nowhere to bury itself in the paneling behind him. He hurried on without looking back. A sourceless glow appeared around him, lighting the way ahead. It was nice to know the passage's built-in magics were still functioning. He glanced back and saw the concealed door had jammed half-shut, caught on the thrown knife. Todd would be sending mercenaries into the passage after him any time now. He grinned coldly.
Oh, good. Let them come. Let them all come. Only I know the secrets in these passageways. Anyone foolish enough to come after me is in for a nasty surprise. When they're all dead, I'll go out into the house, kill Madigan, Todd, and all the other terrorists. They shouldn't have killed the girl. They will pay for that.
Back in the parlor, the smoke began to slowly clear, but terrorists and hostages alike still coughed helplessly, wiping tears from their smarting eyes. The mercenaries rounded up the escaping hostages without too much trouble, and the situation was more or less back under their control. Todd glared into the hidden passageway and gestured quickly to two mercenaries.
Horse, Bishop, take 5 men and go in there after him. You needn't bother to bring all of him back, just the head will do. After that, check the passage for other concealed exits. I don't want anyone else suddenly disappearing on me. Move it!
The two mercenaries nodded quickly, gathered up five men with a quick series of looks and nods, and led the way into the passage. Glenn started to go in after them, but Todd stopped him.
Not you, Glenn. I need you here with me.
I want that bastard. No one does that to me and gets away with it.
He won't get away. Even if he gets out of the passage, there's nowhere he can go. The house is full of our people.
Oh, I don't know, Eleanor. He's fast. I've never seen anyone move like that. And anyway, I want to kill him myself.
Glenn, we've got work to do. The god can wait. He isn't important. Not compared to our purpose here. Now, get yourself another sword and get the girl's body out of here. Show it to the city negotiators and tell them we'll kill another hostage every half hour until our demands are met.
Glenn looked at her, puzzled.
I thought the hostages were just cover.
They are, but as long as the city's concentrating on them, they won't be getting suspicious about what we're really up to. Now do as you're told, Ellis, there's a dear.
Glenn blushed at the endearment and turned quickly to the mercenaries. The hostages watched silently as the girl's body was dragged out. The smoke caught in Todd's throat.
Someone open those windows!
Horse and Bishop led their men cautiously down the narrow stone corridor of the secret passage, checking for other exits as they went. A sourceless glow formed around them, enough to show them the way ahead, but it didn't carry far into the darkness. The rogue guard could be lurking just ahead of the light, waiting in the dark to ambush them. They'd never know until it was too late. Horse shook his head determinedly, pushing aside the thought. If the guard had enough sense to keep running, he'd be long gone by now. But if he was dumb enough to still be hanging around, then he and Bishop would take care of him. They'd dealt with would-be heroes before, and in Horse's experience, they died just as easily as anyone else, particularly when outnumbered by 7-1. Horse was a large, heavily built man in his late 20s, with thick, raggedly cut black hair and a bushy beard. He'd fought in 17 campaigns for various masters and had never once been on the losing side. Horse didn't believe in losing. In his experience, the trick to winning was to have all the advantages on your side, which was why he'd teamed up with Bishop. His fellow mercenary was the same age as he, a head or so taller, but almost twice Horse's size. It wasn't all muscle, but then it didn't have to be. He wasn't the brightest of men either, but Horse was bright enough for both of them, and they both knew it. Besides, Bishop was very creative when it came to interrogating prisoners, especially women. Horse grinned. Bishop stopped suddenly, and Horse stopped with him, glaring back at the other mercenaries when they almost ran into him.
What is it, Bishop?
I'm not sure.
The big mercenary fingered the heavy iron amulet he wore on a chain around his neck and glowered unhappily into the gloom ahead.
Something's wrong, Horse. This place doesn't feel right.
Have you seen something? Heard something?
No. It just doesn't feel right.
The other mercenaries looked at each other, but Horse glared them into silence. He respected Bishop's hunches. They'd paid off before. He gestured to the nearest men.
You two, check out this section, inch by inch if necessary.
The two men looked at each other, shrugged, and moved warily forward, swords at the ready. The light moved with them. There was still no sign of the rogue guard. They'd gone about 10 paces before part of the floor gave slightly under one of the men's feet. They both looked down automatically and consequently never saw the many long pointed wooden stakes which shot out of concealed vents in both walls. The stakes ran them through in a dozen places. They hung there limply, their feet dangling, and blood pooled on the floor below them. There was another soft click as the lever on the floor reset itself, and then the stakes retracted into the walls. The two bodies dropped to the floor.
Damn!
If there's one booby trap, you can bet there are more. For all we know, the whole place could be rigged with them.
One of the other mercenaries voiced the thought most of the others shared.
Then there's no point in going on, is there?
Do you want to go back and tell Todd that?
Horse didn't bother to look around. He smiled briefly at the silence that answered him.
All right, then. We're going on. I'll take the lead. Walk where I do and don't touch anything.
Horse set off slowly, studying the ground before him carefully before gradually lowering his foot onto it. Bishop followed close behind him, all but treading on his heels. The other mercenaries brought up the rear. Horse glowered into the dark ahead of him. The guard they were pursuing must know about the booby traps and how to avoid them. That suggested he was no ordinary guard. It had been obvious from the other hostages' faces that they'd know nothing about the hidden passageway. If they had, they'd have used it. With the guard's special knowledge, he could avoid all the traps and be anywhere in the house by now, but even so, they had to press on. They might not be able to run down the man himself, but at least they could identify the other hidden exits and block them off. Horst threw himself forward instinctively, Bishop at his side. A huge slab of stone dropped from the ceiling, crushing two mercenaries and raising a cloud of dust, which puffed up, filling the passage. Horst made sure that Bishop was all right and then looked back. Blood welled out from under the stone and lapped at the toes of Horst's boots. The sole surviving mercenary on the other side of the stone block stood very still, his face as white as a sheet.
You all right? Hey! Are you all right?
The man turned and ran back up the passage. Some of the light went with him as he fled. Then a section of the floor dropped out from beneath his feet and he disappeared. The trapdoor swung shut, cutting off his scream, and the passage was still and silent again.
This place is a death trap.
Yeah, but the guard got through alive. Probably somewhere out there in the dark right now, watching us and laughing.
He's no ordinary guard, Horst. Did you see the way he flattened Glenn? I didn't think anyone was faster than Glenn.
He's just one man. We can take him. And then you can show him some of your nasty little tricks with a hot iron.
You're welcome to try.
The two mercenaries jumped up and spun around to find Saxon standing behind them, just out of sword's reach. He was smiling. Horst could feel his heart beating hard and fast in his chest, but somehow he kept the shock out of his face. He lifted his sword, and Bishop did the same a second later. Saxon's sword was still in his scabbard, and his hand was nowhere near it.
You shouldn't have come back. You're a dead man now. You're walking and you're breathing, but you're dead. And we're gonna make it last a long time.
Saxon smiled back at him, his eyes cold.
I've had a bad day. The only saving grace is that you're about to have a worse one.
The big mercenary stopped as though he'd run into a wall, his broken ribs collapsing into his chest. He stood hunched over before Saxon, trying to lift his sword and failing. Saxon hit him again, burying his fist in the man's gut up to his wrist. Blood flew from Bishop's mouth, and he sank to his knees. Horst looked at him incredulously. It had all happened so fast. He looked back at Saxon, his sword forgotten in his hand.
Who are you?
I'm Saxon. Wolf Saxon.
You say it like I'm supposed to mean something. But I've never heard of you.
I've been away for a while. People forget. But they'll remember once I've reminded them a few times. You shouldn't have killed the girl, mercenary.
That wasn't me. That was Todd.
You stood by and let it happen. You're guilty. You're all guilty, and I'm gonna kill every last one of you.
What was she to you, Saxon? Your girlfriend? Family?
I never saw before in my life.
Then why?
She was so young. She had all her life before her. She had friends and family who cared for her. And you took all that away.
He leaned forward and took Bishop's head in his hands. The big mercenary shuddered and hadn't the strength to pull away. Saxon looked at Horst.
I'm going to send you back to the others with a message, mercenary. Be sure to tell them who sent it. Tell them Wolf Saxon is back.
Saxon gave Bishop's head a sudden twist and tore it from its shoulders. Horst lost whatever courage he had left.